Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlines between reason and nonsense. I'm your host, Massimo Piliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, Massimo, this is our 13th episode, so you know what that means. It's time to talk about superstition. Specifically, I want to ask, what makes people superstitious? And I mean that question on multiple levels. First, what kind of situations trigger our tendency towards superstitious thinking? And then on a deeper level, why do we have that tendency in the first place? Oh, and I also want to talk about the question you raised in the teaser on our blog. Are there any benefits to superstitious thinking?
Well, it turns out that if we start with the latter, it turns out that there appears to be some benefits. In fact, the idea for part of the readings that I did in preparation for this podcast came from one of our colleagues and friends, Steve Novella, who actually published an article recently on June 7th. About superstition on his blog Neurologica, and he raised this question, you know, mm-hmm. Is superstition all bad? And it turns out that there now begins to be enough research out there that we can start answering the question. So, for instance, one of the most recent articles in on the topic is in Psychological Science, published in May 2010. And the title is Keep Your Fingers Crossed, How Superstition Improves Performance. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the authors have done a series of experiments where they showed that if you say things like break a leg, for instance, or keep your fingers crossed and so on to people before they start engaging in a particular task, they perform better at that task. And the interesting thing about so in other words, the more superstitious or the superstition boost, mm-hmm. basically, increases the performance. Now, what these researchers did was interesting. They also looked in one of their experiments, they looked at what was the mechanism by which this was happening. And they found that it was increased task persistence that constituted the for the advantage.
In other words, they would keep trying longer?
They could keep trying longer because, and apparently the people who tried longer were the ones that were sort of primed with the superstitious, beginning. So if somebody says, well, break a leg or keep your finger crossed or whatever, apparently one of the results of that is that you will keep trying longer. And of course, if you try longer, you're more likely to succeed. So there's nothing mysterious about the success of these people. But what there is that one of the triggers at least, is some kind of superstitious priming of the thing.
I had also read another possibly beneficial effect of superstition that works through another channel. Instead of working because you expect it to work and so you keep trying until it does work, it appears to work by just making you more confident. And for certain kinds of tasks, at least, confidence can increase your likelihood of success. I think the study I read about had people, it involved some sort of like simple motor task, like throwing a ball, and people were more successful at it who had been given some sort of lucky charm or had been allowed to, you know, perform some sort of lucky ritual or something like that. But that at least raises the question of whether there's a downside to this seemingly beneficial effect. A couple of our commenters on Rationally Speaking gave examples of cases in which trusting in a lucky charm could really be bad for you. Someone raised the example of snipers who wear special amulets around their neck that consist of a bullet that is supposedly like the one bullet that could kill them. And since they have it around their neck, they're safe. And so they can't be killed by bullets, which I'm sure that increases your confidence if you believe that. But I'm not sure that that's actually a good thing if you want to live to see the end of your sniping career.
So, as it turns out, there is some quantitative measurement of the negative effects of superstition, although the directional causality in these studies is often very difficult to tell. But for instance, there is a paper published by Sachs in Psychological Reports in 2004 That was actually a confirmation of the fact that, that the effect of superstition, the connection between superstition and other traits is actually cross-cultural, because it holds for both Western subjects and for, in this case, Chinese subjects.
So what were the traits?
But what's interesting is that they found a negative correlation between belief in superstition and rated self-efficacy. In other words, people tend to be less confident about what they can do if they're more superstitious.
Okay, so we don't know which way the direction of causality goes.
We don't know whether it is that superstitious people tend to be as a consequence of the fact that sort of they relinquish basically control to some extent. They're less confident about what they can do, or it is that instead that people who are naturally less self-confident tend to be more superstitious as a sort of a way to counter their lack of self-confidence. We don't know which way the direction goes, but there are some negative effects essentially associated with superstition. And the interesting thing I thought was that they apparently are cross-cultural.
That's strange, because I thought the common wisdom was that superstitions were a way to cope with feeling like you are in an unpredictable and uncontrollable world. And so that's why you see patterns where there are none.
No, that's correct. And in fact, I'm going to cite yet another study in a minute to that effect. But the two things are not mutually exclusive, right? So somebody could have less self-confidence in his own abilities, being superstition is a way to feel that like he has control, like things, somebody is in control,
right?
Like things happen for a reason.
To predict things. It gives you some, you know, if you think you can predict things, then you feel like you have more control. If I wear my red shirt, then I will,
hit the ball. But feeling control that either you or somebody, you know, the universe is in control of things is not necessarily the same thing as being self-confident. So I think the two results are not mutually exclusive. But you're right,
sure,
that there is some interesting research that shows a connection between lack of control and the increased perception of illusory patterns, and that's a paper in Science in 2008 by Whitston and Galinsky. Now, what they did, which was interesting, was they tried to sort of break down the causality, the rational causality, and see what was causing what, essentially. So one of the experiments that they did, they were able to show that the correlation between lack of control and illusory pattern perception was reduced by what they called affirming the self kind of, you know, method. So in other words,
self-affirmation,
like
looking in the mirror and saying, I am beautiful, I am confident.
Something along those lines. No, probably not. But if you somehow can boost the self-confidence of a subject, then that tends to decrease the correlation between the feeling of lack of control and the perception of illusory patterns. In other words, the superstition tends to go away. And that, again, seems to me to make sense psychologically. And there's some interesting evidence out there about it.
So if this is the paper that I'm thinking of, I skimmed over it. And they do a few different experiments where, as you said, they do try to sort of break down the direction of causality by controlling the variable of how in control people feel. But what really struck me as I read these different experiments was that I think there's sort of a number of things going on here that have sort of been conflated, been lumped together. So, for example, I think it's important to distinguish between feeling confused, like feeling like you're in just an unpredictable and completely inscrutable world, and feeling anxious or sort of having a heightened, physiological levels of fear or vulnerability, et cetera. And so those two things often go together. Like this may not have been in this particular paper, but there's one study I read about in several places in which, it wasn't a study, but this scientist observed some fishermen in a tropical island, and he reported that the fishermen who fished in the shallow waters had fewer superstitious rituals and beliefs than the fishermen who fished in the deep waters, because the deep waters had more danger and uncertainty involved in the fishing. And so he saw that their superstitious rituals as a way to cope with that.
Which again makes a general connection between lack of predictability of what's about to happen to you, or lack of predictability about the environment, and superstition.
Right, but what I'm trying to say is lack of predictability or not being able to predict what's going on is different from feeling from how afraid you are. So
correct, right.
I could see like potentially an evolutionary explanation for why, you know, when our pulse is elevated, we tend to see patterns more readily in noise. Because, for example, you know, when we were when our ancestors were wandering through the forests and had to detect whether there was a predator hiding in the bushes or whether it was just, you know, a pattern of light reflecting off the leaves, if they were in a dangerous, unfamiliar area or if they were weak and therefore vulnerable and afraid, they should be more inclined to see a predator instead of just leaves because they need to be better safe than sorry because yeah. they're afraid.
That's right. That's the theory. Yeah, absolutely. That is the theory. Although, as you know, I tend to be fairly careful about evolutionary psychological explanations of human behavior because, you know, that makes perfect sense, except, of course, that we don't really have a way to test whether that is the case or not. Now, we
do
know,
I agree. I'm just saying that these right. are two different channels.
They are. But, of course, there is, in fact, a connection between lack of predictability and stress. I mean, the feeling that you cannot control your environment can cause the stress, and in the picking up patterns that are not there, in other words, being superstitious, may relieve the stress. It clearly doesn't relieve the unpredictability because the superstition doesn't in fact have any particular ground in physical laws. So you're obviously by being superstitious, you're not solving the problem of suddenly gaining actual control over your environment. What you do is you solve or you ameliorate the psychological problem, therefore the anxiety caused by that lack of control. Now let's go back for a second to the evolutionary psychological aspect of it,
right.
despite my caveat earlier on that these theories actually, these hypotheses are actually very difficult to test. But nonetheless, it does make perfect sense that there is an advantage to animals in general in picking up patterns, in the ability to pick up patterns. In the case of human beings, there is the additional complication, of course, that we have these natural tendency to, as Daniel Dennett often put it, to project agency. Mm-hmm. Because we are conscious beings and because there is an advantage, obviously, in trying to figure out what other human beings or other conscious beings are thinking and how they're going to act and so on and so forth, we have a tendency to project agency. We experience that on an everyday basis. You know, when people get mad at their computers or their cars or whatever.
We take it personally.
Exactly. Yeah. We take it personally, right? You sort of project agency.
Man, I take the weather personally.
Yes. There's all sorts of things that we can take personally and this may be a natural, extrapolation, essentially, of the projection of agency, which, by the way, is one of the hypotheses about the origin of religious beliefs, right? The idea that one projects both causal patterns, you know, picks up patterns that are actually not there, and projects agency. If you combine the two together, what you get is that natural processes, natural phenomena are controlled by some kind of agency that is obviously much more powerful and much bigger than you are, and here you have God. So it's the explanation actually does make perfect sense. Now, speaking of atheism, there is another interesting connection, of course, between superstition and atheism, other than the obvious one that, you know, most atheists don't think of themselves and probably are not, in fact, superstitious. But there is an interesting article based on published research that came out in Scientific American recently in May 2010. And the article talks about the superstitious beliefs, in particular the tendency to project agency, you know, sort of to invoke gods or things like that, in people that are affected by Asperger's syndrome. And these people these people tend to have a much, much lower rate of projection of agency, unknown agency, than what the article interestingly calls neurotypical people, in other words, normal people. But the additionally interesting thing is that the neurotypical subjects that are talked about in the article were actually divided into two groups: neurotypical that are also, you know, sort of religious or normally religious believers, and neurotypicals who are atheists. And the idea, of course, was to compare the Aspergers with the atheists, since they both tend to have this rejection of agency projection and so on. But they found a very interesting difference between the two groups. And I'm quoting from the Scientific American article. The atheist, as expected, often invoked anti-teleological responses, such as there is no reason why, things just happen, and so on and so forth. The people with Asperger's were significantly less likely to offer such anti-teleological explanations than the atheists, indicated that we're not engaged in teleological thinking at all. The atheists, in contrast, revealed themselves to be reasoning teleologically, but then they rejected those thoughts. In other words, atheists who are not Aspergers do think teleologically. They do think about projecting agency. They just reject that explanation.
Well, that's because we're so used to hearing people give that explanation that we have to consciously reject it.
Right. But so there's nothing in the atheist brain, so to speak, that makes it less likely to think in teleological terms, is that the teleological terms are analyzed from the point of view of, you know, your belief, your reasons about agency and so on and so forth, and they are rejected.
Now, just to clarify, teleologically means with sort of an end in mind?
That's
like
right. As if there's a plan. It's a goal, and that something is unfolding according to a particular ultimate goal. And it was interesting, therefore, that you can show that a behavioral deficiency can actually cause turning off entirely teleological thinking. So teleological thinking is something that can be turned on or off, apparently, in the brain, depending on how your brain actually happens to work.
Hmm.
Now, if you think of teleological thinking as a particular type of superstitious thinking, then that also means, obviously, that there are certain areas of the brain that specifically can be turned off and would, in fact, eliminate or reduce superstitious thinking. The catch here, of course, is that I'm not so sure that we want to do that in the way in which it's been investigated in this article, because, of course, these people are, in fact, affected by a syndrome that makes them also less socially apt and capable of interacting with other human beings and so on. That may suggest that there is some deep connection between the ability of people to socialize, which does depend on projecting agency on other human beings, and the tendency of then sort of essentially extrapolating that projection of agency outside of the realm of human beings, and therefore start engaging in superstitious behaviors.
And there's also a lot of connection between superstitious behaviors and social bonding. I think I've read about a lot of rituals, especially in, say, sports situations, that have to be engaged in together. And they create this sense of bonding, like all of the things that teams do before a match, all the like incantations and the... I'm kind of making this up because I've never been within 5 feet of a playing field, but I understand that there are these things that sports obsessed people do that involve superstition.
I would never
gather
that.
By the way, Massimo, I feel like we would be remiss in not mentioning the famous quintessential experiment on superstition in pigeons, which was done by the psychologist B.F. Skinner back in the 40s. He took a bunch of pigeons and had a mechanism set up to dispense food to them at regular intervals. And the pigeons, they'd be wandering around the cage doing whatever little pigeony things they do, bopping their heads, turning around. And then suddenly, unexpectedly, they would get a piece of food. And so the pigeons quickly developed an association between whatever behavior they had happened to be doing when the food came and the reception of the food itself. And so they would repeat that behavior again and again. And so quickly, Skinner found himself with cages of pigeons who were just repeating these senseless motions, bopping their heads 3 times or turning around counterclockwise 2 times, thinking that it had some effect on whether they were getting food.
Which is really not much more silly than wearing a particular shirt or hat when you're going to see the Yankees then at their next game.
Right. Well, actually, when I read about this at first, I was like, oh, silly pigeons. But then I was like, well, they actually really don't know. I mean, if the food was randomly given, yeah, they really don't know what caused the food to be given. Whereas humans, when we play roulette, we have all of these superstitious beliefs that we think affect what's going to come next, even though we explicitly know that it's random.
Right. We can make up better stories than pigeons can. But the interesting thing is that kind of experiment has also been repeated in rats. And it turns out that you can get the same behavior to emerge. You can get, superstitious rats. But interestingly, rats actually lose that superstitious behavior pretty quickly. Once they figure out that, in fact, repeating whatever it is that they're doing, the dance around or the bumping on the wall or whatever, once they figure out that it's not working anymore, that it's not giving them the food or the reward anymore, then they stop doing it. Unlike human beings who actually continues to be superstitious, regardless essentially of the outcome. So it's really interesting.
Because we remember the few
so we're more
times
stupid.
In which we do the thing and we get the result we want, and we forget all of the misses in which we do the thing, we wear the shirt or we carry the charm and the outcome we wanted doesn't
happen.
That's
a fancy way to say that we're more stupid than rats.
Right.
There's one more study that I want to bring up before we wrap up this sort of this discussion on superstition, which is one on the connection between childhood physical abuse and development of belief in the paranormal. This is a study that came out in 2006 in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease. And what they found was that there is, in fact, a connection, meaning that people who have been abused as children do tend to develop more strong paranormal beliefs than people who are not being abused. And again, the general idea is that there is a connection there between the feeling of lack of control and the origin of superstition. But the interesting thing about this study is that not all superstitions apparently are created equal in this sense. For instance, the researchers found that precognition, spiritualism, psi in general, were significantly higher in abused as opposed to non-abused subjects. Witchcraft was, of all things, found to be the most strongly held belief among those that had a history of abuses. But other beliefs, on the other hand, other paranormal beliefs, did not work quite as well. And in particular, for instance, religious beliefs were no different between the abused people and the control group.
Interesting.
So not all paranormal beliefs apparently are equally efficacious, at least in this particular context. And the interesting part is that religion of all of them doesn't appear to be making much of a difference in the case, at least in the specific case of people with physical abuse as children.
Well, Massimo, I feel like we should probably quickly wrap up before something terrible happens, seeing as this is our 13th episode. No! Well, lucky thing I carried my rabbit's foot with me this whole time to protect us from the unluckiness of episode 13. Let's continue on to the Rationally Speaking Picks.
Welcome back. Every episode, including episode 13, Julie and I pick a couple of our favorite books, movies, websites, or whatever tickles our rational fancy. Let's start with Julia's pick.
Thanks, Massimo. My pick is a book that just came out recently. It's called How Pleasure Works by Paul Bloom. I really liked this book, and I don't want to say too much about it yet because I actually plan to write a blog post about it. But there's one section of the book that actually turned out to be really relevant to the topic of this episode. So just in brief, the book is about how, the common thread running through it is how the pleasure that we get out of something, an object or a person or a food, is not just about the physical properties of that thing, like how it tastes or looks or sounds or our actual experience with it, but it's also largely based on our beliefs about that thing that don't have anything to do with its physical properties. So, for example, that's why people will get more pleasure out of the same glass of wine if they think that it's rare and expensive than if they think that it's, you know, a common cheap table wine, even if it's the exact same wine and they've tested this. And it's also the reason why we get far more pleasure out of a painting if we think it comes from a famous celebrated artist than if it's a forgery, even if the forgery is so good that it's identical to the real painting. And the reason that this is relevant to superstition is that a lot of Paul Bloom's research has been about the belief that there's a sort of vague essence, an immaterial but real essence in objects that has to do with their history and where they've been and what they've been in close proximity to. You'll see this in a lot of religious or spiritual beliefs, that something can have power or can have specialness, and that special essence can be transmitted by touching it or by being close to it. And you see this in secular culture as well. So, for example, this is why people will pay so much for an article of clothing that's been worn by a celebrity or an object that's belonged to a celebrity. And so what Bloom and others have found is that there are these interesting rules about how this sort of special essence is transmitted. So obviously, you know, it can be transmitted through touch. Like if a celebrity has touched something, it's worth a lot. If the celebrity has worn that thing, it's worth even more. But you also get this interesting transitivity of special essence. So like, for example, there's a photographer who sold... I think he was trying to photograph Britney Spears, and her car ran over his foot. And so he's selling the shoe that he was wearing when Britney Spears' car ran over his foot. And so Britney Spears never touched his foot, but she touched her car because she was sitting in it. And the car touched his shoe, and the shoe touched his foot. So this shoe is now worth a lot. It's not worth as much as it would be if Britney Spears had actually touched it, but, you know, there's this transitivity.
That reminds me of several years ago, I think it was a couple of World Cups ago, soccer World Cups. The International Federation of Soccer decided to cut up the grass of which the games have been played and sell it in tiny little squares.
Yes, and exactly.
And of course, the squares that went for the highest bidding were the ones that allegedly had the spinning of Maradona, who was a major player for Argentina. On it. Now, I'm not sure that I would pay a lot of money for somebody else's spit in my living room, but there you go. That's another example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, he's also found that articles of clothing worn by celebrities are worth a lot less if they've been cleaned. So like an auction house,
the
essence is gone. You've sterilized it away. Yeah.
Of course. Well, my pick for this episode is a website. It's called Episteme Links, episteme-links.com. You'll find the link on our website. And it's a general, very, very, very well put together set of resources of philosophy on the internet. And there's all sorts of serious stuff. You can look up individual departments of philosophy throughout the country. You can look up individual faculty. You can look at a lot of interesting things. But there is also some less serious issues. They have an entire store, for instance, where you can buy all sorts of t-shirts and caps and all that with philosophical themes. And some of them are actually very funny. I have to admit that I got a couple of those at home. But it's also a very serious sort of general portal for anything philosophical. If you have anything, if you're curious about who's doing research in philosophy in whatever area, you'll find it there at Episteme Links.
Massimo, is this where you got your I'm into analytic philosophy t-shirt?
That's right.
You know, I love that on you. You look so much smarter when you wear that t-shirt.
I know. I'll do it more often.
Can I get a piece of the floor of the room in which Kant wrote his critique of pure reason?
Not on Episteme Links, but I'm sure there's somebody out there that might be able to sell that sort of thing. Although, you know, the Germans are pretty uptight about selling historical paraphernalia. So,
well, I think probably a lot of the molecules in my body right now were also in Kant's body. So I don't know why I would spend that much money on
That's right. You already got it just by recycling, regular recycling. Yeah.
Right. I probably shouldn't publicize that fact too much, though, or a lot of business on eBay is going to drop.
Not to mention your dating patterns are going to go down because, you know, Kant was
no one wants to date someone who's part Kant. Thanks, Massimo. Please don't tell my boyfriends that.
No.
This has been another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.